This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And now, listen to this.
Nothing's gonna harm you, not while I'm around.
The simple, heroic act of taking care of someone who needs you.
Nothing's gonna harm you, no sir, not while I'm around.
Classic Stephen Sondheim there. But the condition of being a caregiver goes way beyond familiar. It's part of the fabric of American society itself. Each day, millions of men and women rise to greet a daily responsibility for someone they love. But someone whose care can challenge everything about their quality of life.
I know so many families that have charged services for their kids, and we don't make enough. You know, working families do not make enough to pay for the care of special needs kids on their own.
That's Linda Carney Goodrich, whose son Philip has autism. We'll hear more of her story in just a few minutes. Linda is just one of the nearly 66 million Americans each day responsible for someone to keep them safe and well, to be around. They are caregivers of an aging adult or an adult special needs child, severely injured veteran. The caregiver is certainly the most common and commonly unrecognized job in America. There are no tax breaks for caregiver work, certainly no pay, and often no breaks in a routine that is a matter of life and death to the person being cared for. All this week at The Takeaway, we want to recognize this workforce of caregivers, introduce them to you, collect your stories of being a caregiver. We know there are plenty of you out there doing this job. We want to simply ask, how are you doing? How's it going today? If we can just for a moment put aside the feeling of being alone out there, we will have done a lot, I think. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway using the hashtag #ICareFor. But first, some numbers that tell the story of just how big this caregiving job is. Joining us now is Dante Chinney, director of the American Communities Project at American University. Dante, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, John.
If we were to think about this around the United States, are there places in the U.S. where there are much greater investments and much greater needs as far as caregiving is concerned than others?
One way you can really kind of measure it is by looking at the aging population in the United States. And of course, people get to a certain age, and there is the great sandwich generation problem of having to take care of older people as well as taking care of kids. And you look at the population 62 and over and where it's based in the country, and it is really heavily based in rural America. It's based in these places that I call working class country. That's kind of like rural places without a lot of agriculture. Huge swath of America called graying America, and a place we call the aging farmlands. These places have a couple things in common. They are overwhelmingly rural. And they are not high income. These are low income places. And a lot of these rural places, the younger folks have moved away. And these places have kind of unique challenges, I think.
So the investments that these people are making in caregiving are bearing directly on their income, their quality of life, the prospect of them being in poverty or not.
That's absolutely true. And then the other question, I think, for them is, as you get older, is it a question where these people who live in rural America either, you know, have to pick up and move to be near loved ones who can take care of them? Or do they have somebody move back to them? I mean, we kind of have this geographic disparity now where you have people aging in one part of the country and there really isn't a lot of care for them in those places. And it's going to be something, I think, to really follow in the next 10 years.
I read a statistic that women who are caregivers are 2.5 times more likely than non-caregivers to live in poverty, 5 times more likely to receive supplemental security income, to have actually burned through all of their savings. That has a real tangible impact in communities.
That's a really interesting statistic, and it does not surprise me at all. That, and my guess is if you could get those kinds of figures mapped, you would see some of those kind of problems in more urban and even suburban areas where problems have fallen on somebody in the family. And I don't mean that, I don't mean to put it that way, but like the responsibilities have fallen on somebody in the family. And they're going to tend to fall on women, and especially if you've got women who are single parents, then you have an amazing amount of responsibility falling on those people.
And anything of a scale of nearly 66 million you're going to find in every geographic area. But going back to the rural for a moment, rural communities, I believe, are overrepresented in terms of their proximity to military facilities, whether or not they actually served in the wars. And so some of the veteran caregiver issues are probably overrepresented in rural areas as well.
Yeah, rural places score very, very high in terms of having veterans, much higher than the nation at large. So when I looked at where veteran populations are located, they are, again, most heavily located in those three areas we talked about, graying America, these aging farmlands, and working class country. But the other place that pops up are these places around military posts. And 17, maybe not surprisingly, but 17% of the population in those areas, they're veterans. And those places also do tend to be rural. It's a big, big issue when you get out into rural America, especially around these bases, just large numbers of veterans. And those are unique problems, of course, physical and psychological challenges for those communities.
The caregiver map of the United States, helping us to see that map more clearly, is Dante Chinney, director of the American Communities Project at American University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I want to introduce you now to two caregivers who are both full-time moms in the Boston area, responsible for two adult special needs children, but they could be anywhere in the U.S., part of the 65.7 million strong workforce of caregivers. Susan Senator takes care of her adult autistic son, Nat, and Linda Carney Goodrich takes care of her adult autistic son, Philip. And as Linda tells us, it takes a lot of tenderness and sheer hard work to be a caregiver.
My son is at home because he got sick in the group home and they weren't able to care for him there. And I have two other children, a 9-year-old and a 4-year-old. And then I feel constantly torn because my other children need me too. And it's a real dilemma because his caregiving is really a full-time job. You know, and he's almost 24 years old. And I don't see an end in sight to that. So I feel, you know, exhausted and powerless sometimes. You know, I still do it, but feels like I've been waging a war for 20 years.
What time's your alarm turn on, Linda?
Well, I get up to run in the morning at 4:30 so I can get some exercise for myself. Then I get back about an hour later, and the first thing is trying to get my son out of bed because he does have a job in the community, but it takes him it could sometimes take him 2 hours to get out the door. So I have to get on him early.
And on your way to the car, do you have your special lunch?
Oh, yes. I have to make this, but he can't eat anything out. He has to measure everything and bring all the food he needs for the day. That's one of the reasons why I get up so early, is to manage the food for the day. And then he has to log everything. And he doesn't understand we have a computer program for that, but he doesn't understand it. So he often records things wrong, and then I have to fix it. So it's a lot just taking care of his dietary needs, not even the autism piece, you know.
Susan, give me your sort of clock of the day, morning to evening. It's obviously different, but I'm sure you heard some of the same things there.
Yeah, I mean, the emotional and psychological toll is the same, but the actual day-to-day is different because Nat, during the week, is in his group home and in his program. So even though I have a great service provider and he's got good staff, I still worry a lot about, is he safe? I never know if he's sick because he can't talk. I mean, his talking is just incredibly basic. You know, if you ask him, are you sick, he'll say yes. And then if you say, are you feeling well, he'll say yes. So you just have to kind of guess. And then on the weekends, it's different. It's a bit more like Linda's in that, you know, I get up early. I try to keep him quiet so my husband at least can sleep, keep him from flushing the toilet over and over again, have him stop walking around so much because he walks constantly. We clocked him once and it was 4 miles in the house before we even got outside. And I'm laughing, but it's really hard. You know, it's not funny. It's hard.
Is the responsibility that you have for these two individuals yours and yours alone in our society? And is that isolating?
Well, it feels that way to me because the services that are offered aren't good enough. They're just not. When Philip qualified for the group home, he was in a group home until his needs became too great, right? But when he qualified for the group home, they didn't let us know until a week before his 22nd birthday. And they didn't give him any choice about where he would live. And they put him in a group home with nonverbal guys in their 50s. And this was a 22-year-old kid. He didn't have any choice about what his roommates would be, what his life would be like. And as a parent, you're so relieved, right? You hit the lottery if you get a placement. But the placement is so bad that you feel guilty. So he came home from the group home with bruises from another client in the group home, and no one could really explain why that happened. So now he's home and really sick. He's developed seizures, and he developed an illness, an enzyme deficiency problem, where he has diarrhea every day, and he's lost 30 pounds, and he is exhausted. He is frail right now. He is vulnerable. So I feel tormented. I feel like there's no good option. And, you know, I feel tired. You know, it's been many years I had to fight for an education for him. And what a parent really wants, I think, when your kid grows up is to feel that they're in a place where they belong. Maybe they're not, you know, a lawyer. Maybe they're not even cured from a disability, right? But at least that they're happy and they're in a place where people love them and that they belong. And right now, it's not that, you know.
And in America, it's all on you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because as a mother, you're really expected to sacrifice and somehow find a way to do it all. You really are expected. And if you're not doing paid work, times when I haven't been able to work because Philip's needs are so great, it's devalued. The care work is so devalued. Caring for elderly, caring for disabled people, caring for children, it's so important.
Do you ever get the message in America on any level in the media, from me speaking, from anyone, anywhere, hey, how you doing, Linda? How you doing, Susan? How's it going?
No. No.
I mean, the fact that you're doing this show feels like, you know, wow, this must mean this is becoming a really big deal in the country.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's so many kids coming of age now with these disabilities, we're going to really have to figure out a solution.
So in both of your cases, your children will survive you, right? That's your expectation.
Yes.
Yeah.
For a while, yeah. Our plan, my plan was, we won't die. And then we realized that's not an option. So we really had to try to figure this out and sit down with lawyers and sit down with other parents and people who've been there and people who know. And, you know, you have to think, who could be taking care of my guy when I'm gone? And, oh my God, it has to be his siblings. And what a thing to put on them.
Well, let me just say, since I brought it up, how are you guys doing?
I'm, you know, the same level of stress as always. What are we going to do with Natty? Is he going to be okay, or is he going to have a meltdown at work? You know.
All the questions.
Yeah.
Linda, how you doing?
Today I'm good because this interview is making me feel hopeful. But day to day, I mean, yesterday I felt really at the end. And, you know, not at the end, but, you know, you get so burnt out and you don't see relief, do you know? So that's the thing. Sometimes the grief and the guilt are so, they're just so big.
And we're their mother and we can't help them sometimes. And that's the worst pain.
Well, I'm maybe a big softy here, but I do get the sense that all these children are very, very lucky to have both of you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Susan Senator is mother to Nat Batchelder, an autistic adult living in a residential facility, and Linda Carney Goodrich is mother to Philip Carney Goodrich. He's an adult living at home. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
If you are a caregiver, we really do want to hear your story. Tell us at 8778MyTake or tweet us at The Takeaway using the hashtag #ICareFor. This is The Takeaway. Experts and policy wonks might call this an interesting case of federalism in the United States, but can states enforce and protect a right to privacy when the federal government and the NSA, at the center of the latest domestic surveillance controversy, seem to believe national security trumps the right to any expectation that electronic communications be private? Last week, New Jersey's Supreme Court said regardless of federal policy, state law enforcement officers are required to get a warrant from a judge in order to track someone with a cell phone using information obtained from the cell network. New Jersey is just one of a number of states and jurisdictions with their own ideas of how to set the boundary between citizens' rights to privacy of personal data and the needs of law enforcement on the other. Justice Peter Verniero, a former New Jersey Attorney General and state Supreme Court justice, joins us. Justice, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John. It's good to be here.
Also with us is Susan Freewald. She's a University of San Francisco law professor. Professor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So, Justice, let's begin with you. Peter Verniero, what's the significance of this New Jersey decision in your view?
Well, the significance is this is the first time that our New Jersey Supreme Court has held that police must obtain a warrant in order to track someone's whereabouts by use of a cell phone, or they have to have an exception to the warrant requirement, such as an emergency aid or something of that nature. This may be the first Supreme Court decision of any state court in the country, so it's certainly very significant, and I think you will see many more of these cases in other jurisdictions.
Professor Freewald, can you divide a right to privacy on the question of standing for state law enforcement, local law enforcement, and federal law enforcement? It would seem to be the same regardless.
Well, you can in the sense of you look at what kind of case it is, what's the nature of the charges, who is doing the investigation. But I think the interest should be the same, and I think the reasoning of the court should be persuasive in federal cases as well as state cases.
Does this mean that states are on the cutting edge of defining privacy law in the digital era, or will there be a conflict here that will be resolved in favor of either the state or the federal government at some point? Susan Freewald.
I think it's the former. I think states are on the cutting edge. One of the things that's important to recognize is that the Supreme Court gets into these questions very rarely. So the government, in fact, the NSA lawyers and others are making their arguments about this area based on cases from the 70s. And so New Jersey has gotten into an issue that the Supreme Court hasn't actually weighed in on yet, in the sense of they're talking about cell site location information instead of GPS tracking information.
Justice Vernero, do you think the state of New Jersey can set a precedent that the federal government would be bound by on some level if this ever gets to the Supreme Court?
No, the New Jersey Supreme Court cannot bind the United States Supreme Court on questions of federal law. However, the state Supreme Court does have the final word as to questions under the state constitution. And so long as there's no federal rule that's in conflict with the state constitutional law, then this decision will be binding, even if the United States Supreme Court says that it's permissible on the federal level. In other words, state Supreme Courts can afford individuals in those states with greater constitutional protections.
Now, this seems as though, and correct me if I'm wrong, that we are evolving towards a situation, Justice Vernero, where the states may have a very, very meticulous and you know, high threshold of violations of privacy by law enforcement, and the federal government would routinely just be trolling electronic data based on its view of the right to privacy. Is that where we're headed?
Well, in this court decision that we're talking about, the court selected the typical probable cause standard. It did not create a new standard. It simply said that when you search the cell phone locations of an individual through the cell phone, you need a warrant issued by a neutral judge based on probable cause. That's a very familiar standard in the law. The court gave the state government here in New Jersey 30 days to train its officers and to ensure compliance, and I have every reason to believe that New Jersey will comply because we have a very professional law enforcement community in this state. So I don't think it's a new standard per se. It's just a new ruling, first of its kind.
Susan Freewald, do you think we're evolving to a situation where in cases of criminal investigations, real judges and real warrants will be required for digital information, but in the case of mass data and preventive security strategies, that sort of thing, that the federal government is free to do whatever it wants without a warrant or with only the most cursory kind of warrant?
Well, no. I mean, the distinction that the federal government is making is a distinction between non-content data and content data, and they're making it both in the criminal context and in the national security context, and they're making it in the case of one person as well as the case of, you know, millions of people. So it's an important principle that the New Jersey Supreme Court rejected, which is that both non-content information isn't protected by the Constitution, by the Fourth Amendment, well, by the analogous part of the New Jersey Constitution to the Fourth Amendment. They said it is protected, and that even information in the hands of a third party is protected because they said that when you use your cell phone, you don't intend to give the police this 24-hour tracking device, even if you do intend for the cell phone company to know where you are in order to connect your calls.
State courts on the cutting edge of possibly defining a 21st century right to privacy. Susan Freewald is a professor of law at the University of San Francisco Law School. And Justice Peter Verniero is a former New Jersey Attorney General and State Supreme Court Justice. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
A boy's born in hot damn Mississippi.
A little later in the program, we'll have a conversation about how the George Zimmerman verdict and the Trayvon Martin case may have affected the presidency of Barack Obama. But first, in the week since the verdict, musician Stevie Wonder announced that he'd be boycotting the state of Florida and all other states with Stand Your Ground laws. He's been joined by Dionne Warwick and the pop gospel duo Mary Mary, among others. But what do people in Florida, specifically those in the Florida music scene, think about this boycott? We reached out to Jerry Dufresne. He's co-owner of the Orpheum, which is a music venue in Tampa, Florida. Jerry joins us from takeaway affiliate WUSF in Tampa. Jerry, welcome to the show.
Hi, John.
Do you think this is long-lived, this boycott, that it's going to stick? And just what's your reaction, your impression?
I think it will last about as long as it's in the media. My impression of it is that it's not anything that's going to last for very long.
Have you ever seen anything like this in the past, where musicians, decided to boycott a specific venue? I remember Sun City in South Africa. That worked for a while, but ultimately that wasn't even effective.
Well, I think that music is inherently political, and I think that musicians should use their voices, but I think there's probably more effective ways than what they're doing. Who exactly are they hurting by not coming? Who are they affecting? What is going to happen based on this? I don't know that it's going to change any of the laws. I think there's more effective ways to protest.
We reached out to Stevie Wonder for a statement or an interview regarding the boycott. His reps say he'll be saying nothing further on the matter at this time. Do you think music audiences, concert-going audiences, are aware of these kinds of issues and are likely to weigh in if they were to consider this boycott significant?
I think they may. At the same time, I don't know that this kind of protest is what works. Wouldn't something more effective be if he actually came down here? Wouldn't something more effective be if he put on a show? Who is he hurting? Large multinational corporations like Live Nation and AEG are not going to make the money when he comes to perform. What difference does that make? Who does that help? Who does it hurt?
Live Nation, of course, the ticket-selling company that's so involved in live events. Are you inviting Jerry Dufresne, co-owner of the Orpheum? Are you inviting Stevie Wonder to do a show at the Orpheum?
I would love it. He's more than welcome to come to the Orpheum. I don't know that Stevie has played one of my size venues since the 60s, maybe even before.
How many people does the Orpheum
see? We're a 720 capacity venue. So Stevie Wonder has maybe walked through a venue our size in the past 15 years. But so we're a little bit smaller. But at the same time, any artist can decide to kind of boycott Florida. And it's... If we get artists that start to do that with us as well, I mean, it would have an effect.
But so far, you haven't heard anything, and the acts that would be very, very interested in your venue have said nothing at this point.
No, at this point, we haven't had any kind of feedback from any kind of mid-level to smaller modern acts right now.
Who's playing at the Orpheum this week?
This week we actually have Slum Village, the Detroit hip hop group from the 70s. Former members are J Dilla, JD, who I think has a pretty big effect on what's going on with urban music, and we haven't heard a thing from them about anything like this.
Jerry Dufresne is co-owner of the Orpheum Music Venue in Ybor City, Tampa, Florida. Thanks so much, Jerry.
Thanks, John.
If you think about it, it's been a tough week for the state of Florida all the way around.
According to current Florida law, you can get a gun, follow an unarmed minor, call the police, have them explicitly tell you to stop following them, then choose to ignore that, keep following the minor, get into a confrontation with them, and if at any point during that process you get scared, you can shoot the minor to death, and the state of Florida will say, well, look, you did what you could.
The analysis there of the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman case from The Daily Show's John Oliver last week, certainly not very charitable to the state of Florida. What is the Florida buzz to all of the media backlash in the wake of the verdict? Joining us is Craig Kopp, host of the Takeaway Affiliate, host at Takeaway Affiliate WUSF in Tampa, Florida. Craig, welcome to the program.
Hi, John.
I suppose with homegrown critics of Florida like Carl Hiaasen right there in South Florida, you're used to critics and criticism, but how's it been over the last week and what reaction are you getting?
Yeah, Carl Hiaasen's made a nice living making fun of the state he lives in. The John Oliver thing, brilliantly done, kind of, I think, makes Floridians miss the other John a little on The Daily Show because that was pretty hard-hitting, and then he wanted to change the Sunshine State's name to the worst state. Hey, it stings a little. There were a lot of columns over the weekend in all sorts of papers. It hurts a little, but frankly, Carl Hiaasen is a great example. Florida has always embraced its weirdness. It's not like Florida doesn't make headlines for man who beats wife with toaster all the time. This stings a little more because it's a rough issue all around. The Trayvon Martin case is emotional from both sides of the issue, and I think the bottom line is that Floridians look at this and say, when they hear a commentator on a cable network news say, if Floridians love their guns, they go, yeah, those who have guns probably love their guns as much as those who have guns in North Carolina or Ohio or New York. They think we're kind of being singled out on the standard ground law. Stevie Wonder, you know, will be boycotting over 30 states if he boycotts every state that has a standard ground law. Florida's not alone in that.
And, you know, some have said, even on this program, that one way of looking at the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman case is that Florida is ahead of the nation in the sense of dealing with the questions of people carrying weapons, racial prejudice, the notion of profiling much more honestly and ahead of the rest of the nation on some level. Any folks saying that?
I haven't seen that talked about very much. It's more, you know, this is a state full of people who aren't from here, really. And so there are plenty of people who are interested in the issue. It does seem to be way more on the surface than in other states. It's getting a lot of attention. This case made it get a lot of attention. Nobody's saying we're ahead of the curve. I think every state in the union, every city in this country is facing these kinds of issues. We're just the ones where the media spotlight has been focused. So the state of Florida is where the issue is being debated. People certainly don't want their state maligned. People love it here. We have beaches. When our troubles hit us, we go and stare at a big ocean or the Gulf of Mexico. It's just I've only been here for 2 years, John. It's just a different everything from the weather on down is unlike any state I've ever visited.
Craig Kopp, afternoon host at Takeaway Affiliate WUSF in Tampa. What are people saying? Is this incident more emotional in terms of the media spotlight or the 2000 election, the old hanging chads business?
That's a really good question. I think there's a lot more emotion. That was political emotion. There's a lot of fire around a political issue. There's real emotion. I feel that on all levels here. The governor of the state who formed a commission right after this and went out and looked at the standard ground law. Now, his bipartisan commission came back and said the law really doesn't need to be changed. It's just fine. People question that. Some people did. Some people didn't. But the governor constantly talks about both Trayvon Martin's family and George Zimmerman's family in terms of the hurt and pain that has gone through all this. I think everybody in the state of Florida feels this on a different level than, say, you know, an argument over a hanging chad.
Craig Kopp, afternoon host at Takeaway Affiliate WUSF in Tampa, Florida. Thanks, Craig.
Thank you.
In the global food industry, there are crops that end up on your plate, foods like bananas and asparagus, and then there are agricultural commodities like corn syrup or soybean oil. Commodities like these drive the processing of food and even make their way into non-food items that must be safe for human contact and consumption, shampoos, cosmetics, even toothpaste. The wide variety of uses, plus the global scale of demand, all mean that a commodity can quickly become so valuable it can transform the places where it is produced and the people who produce it. Such is the case for palm oil. A U.S. Department of Labor report on child and forced labor in 2012 identified palm oil, along with gold, seafood, and clothing, as having the worst track record on labor practices. Palm oil can be found in your own cupboards, kitchen, and bathroom. It's even more widely used in Asia. Benjamin Skinner, reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek and senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University, says the story of palm oil is a 21st century update to a familiar tale of industrial greed and the temptation to turn workers into slaves.
This is one of those cases where you see a number of macro factors coming together. One of the big ones here, what we focused on, was the rising consumer giants of China and India, but particularly China. What we tried to understand was, do they care about the human costs of the products that are fueling that rise? What we found is they care deeply about the environmental costs. They care deeply about product safety. But when it comes to the human costs, and here we're talking about slavery, slaves being those forced to work, held through fraud, under threat of violence for no pay beyond subsistence, they're largely ignorant. And according to the surveys, less than 5% of Chinese actually care about the labor inputs to their goods.
And is that a lesson that these companies came up with on their own, or is it part of a traditional, shadowy, dark business model that might have something to do with the rise of other industrial commodities over the last 100 years?
I think a lot of it has to do with the breakneck growth of this particular commodity. Over the last 23 years, global usage, global consumption of palm oil has quintupled, largely thanks to, again, the booming consumer giants in China and India. And over that period, Indonesia has become the largest producer of palm oil. Indonesia is a place where these companies are quite aware, and I interviewed the CEO just a couple of days ago of the big company that we name in the story, the $3 billion company, Kuala Lumpur Kepong. And his comment about Indonesian rule of law revealed that he was perfectly aware that Indonesian rule of law was extremely weak. And for example, when it was brought to his attention, and it was brought to his attention 3 years ago, that there was somebody who was using, as he put it in quotation marks, slavery to produce the palm oil that his company was selling to China, selling all over the world, the response was to fire that individual but not to press charges. Mm. When I asked him point blank, is slavery a crime, he said absolutely. But then he went on to say, but you have to understand the Indonesian context.
There's a sense here of both ruthlessness and caginess. Mm-hmm. That I'm wondering is echoed in, a very different story of companies like Archer Daniels Midland that grew in other industrial commodities. I mean, are you seeing something fundamentally different here? Or are you seeing a kind of ruthlessness that's been repeated over and over again?
You know, what I'm seeing is a kind of opacity repeated over and over again, where there are these liability firewalls built in, where KLK says, well, this was the fault of the contractors. We didn't actually contract with those laborers. And when it came time to pay reparations to these workers, to be clear, here we're talking about at least 95, probably over 100 men, women, and children who were held in brutal conditions, locked inside on these isolated barracks in the middle of palm oil plantations in the middle of Borneo, 2,000 miles away from their home. They were beaten regularly. If they tried to run away, they were captured. They were actually, like in the antebellum South, you had slave hunters who would go out and catch these runaways and bring them back and beat them in front of the others. I mean, this is medieval.
Is there something about the production of palm oil, the harvesting of the agricultural, items that produce palm oil that is similar to the labor-intensive qualities of the cotton harvest that you've just sort of alluded to?
Absolutely. It's a labor-intensive industry. It relies on these out-of-the-way plantations in places like Indonesia, as I say, where the rule of law is weak. And fundamentally, it comes through layers. The commodity comes through layers and winds up everywhere. It's a ubiquitous product.
Are there brands in Asia that do reflect a sense of transparency and social responsibility, like we've come to know with Nike and the struggle to have garment manufacturers project that their garments are manufactured in a socially appropriate humanitarian way?
On an extremely limited basis. What you do have is you have Western multinationals that sell to China and are increasingly the trusted brands. Here's the thing. In China, they care enormously about product safety. They care more than they do in the West about environmental issues. Why? Because you go to Linfen, you go to Tianjin, you have to walk around with a respirator. So increasingly, those issues are important. The problem is Chinese brands haven't caught up with that latent consumer demand.
So personally, what product with a lot of palm oil in it do you suddenly have a different relationship with based on your reporting here?
Well, one thing is I've been allergic to sodium lauryl sulfate for years, so I have a built-in aversion to that particular palm oil derivative. The truth is it's hard to find where this stuff winds up in terms of the derivatives. In many cases,
that's part of its industrial charm. It's environmentally benign. It is colorless, odorless, tasteless kind of thing, and it's very, very easy to use in a food service context as well as a consumer product context.
Well, I wouldn't say it's environmentally benign, first of all.
But you can eat it, and it's not like petroleum oil.
That's true. That's true. And it's in terms of saturated fats, it's actually much better for you than other forms of vegetable oil. So it was the preferred form of oil, of vegetable oil, over the last 20 years. The problem is all of these other social problems. Now, what we find, what I'm getting a sense of when we talk to these companies, when we go out for this story and, you know, talk to Cargill, talk to a Procter & Gamble, talk to Kraft, talk to all of the companies that we connected with the KLK oil, fundamentally there's a sense that the market will reward transparency. And this is one of these, to paraphrase Trotsky, these companies may not be interested in transparency, but ultimately when journalists get involved, transparency is interested in them.
So this article may be something of a tipping point for this industry.
We hope.
Benjamin Skinner, Bloomberg Businessweek reporter and senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bloomberg asked companies with well-known brands who use palm oil about the allegations of abuse. California Oils, Kellogg, General Mills, P&G, and Unilever cited supplier codes of conduct that prohibit such practices, while Nestle and Archer Daniels Midland pledged to investigate. Finally this hour, we've had all weekend to absorb and think about these words from the president on Friday.
Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago. And for those who resist that idea that we should think about something like these Stand Your Ground laws, I just ask people to consider, if Trayvon Martin was of age and armed, could he have stood his ground on that sidewalk?
We've also had more than a week to consider the verdict in the George Zimmerman case, not guilty in the shooting of Trayvon Martin. But for some in America, including the president, and he spoke to us on Friday, it's something that did not begin with this case and will not end with this verdict.
There are very few African-American men in this country who haven't had the experience of being followed when they were shopping in a department store. That includes me. The African-American community is looking at this issue through a set of experiences and a history that doesn't go away.
Question, does that distinct set of experiences the president referred to ultimately divide us as a nation, or can a shared history finally bridge that divide? Was the president a bridge builder on Friday? How has his identity, his place in history, been affected by these events and his response to them? On the line with us is Hermine Hartman, editor-in-chief of Indigo magazine in Chicago. Hermine has been a frequent guest on this program during the 2012 presidential election and in our discussions of race in America. Hermine, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Good day, John. How are you today?
I'm great. Let's talk first about you. In 2012, were very critical of the president not representing African Americans on issues that were of great concern to them. Do you think this is another case where he spoke maybe a little too late, in your view?
I'm glad he spoke, and I'm glad he spoke as he did. I'm glad he spoke as, one, the president of the United States, but I'm glad he spoke as a black man of the United States and spoke to the experiences that the majority of black men in America have, what we teach young men about being careful on the streets and how to be respectful and polite with law enforcement officers so that it does not cause their life. This is a moment. This is a historical moment. It could be a pivotal moment in race relations in America. I'm glad he spoke when he spoke.
How did you think he felt about it? Give me a sense of, was he comfortable going down this road? Was he uncomfortable being this voice, as you could tell on Friday?
I think he spoke from his heart. And in my book, I think Barack Obama is best when he is speaking from his heart. It's authentic. It's real. You know, I think the whole race question and discussion in America has a divide in it. And the divide is real simple. Black people see it one way, and white people see it another way. There's some black experiences that whites don't know about and they don't share. There's some white privilege black America doesn't know about and we don't share. So I think the discussion is honest and very open, and I think very needed.
I want to come back to that issue of the divided set of experiences that you laid out there so eloquently. But listen here to colleague Tavis Smiley on Meet the Press in a roundtable discussion on what President Obama's words really meant in the wake of the Zimmerman verdict. And Tavis Smiley was very, very critical of the president. Listen.
On this issue, you cannot lead from behind. What's lacking in this moment is moral leadership. The country is begging for it. They're craving it. And I disagree with the president respectfully that politicians, elected officials, can't occupy this space on race. Lincoln did, Truman did, Johnson did, President Obama did. He's the right person in the right place at the right time.
Although Tavis Smiley said he was late in coming to the podium. What do you believe? What do you think about what Tavis Smiley said there?
I don't want to get into whether he was late or whether he was early. I mean, what's the right time? The verdict was in. We are a country of laws. We live by laws. Do I agree with the verdict? No. I think the verdict is outrageous. John, here's something we've got to put in perspective, and you must remember, and the black community's attitude is never again. We have seen in our country lynchings, and everybody in the town knew who did the lynchings, and no one was arrested or no one was tried or cases were thrown out of court. We have seen Emmett Till. I did a blog, and I call this the Emmett Till of 2013. We saw them walk away, and we also saw them confess after the verdict that they did it. So there's been a history. We cannot look at this in a vacuum. We've got to look at this in a context. The president is aware of this. He knows this. I mean, can you imagine getting arrested, thrown up against the car, handcuffed because you were walking down the street because you had on jeans and a hoodie, or because you might have been in, quote, the wrong neighborhood? I mean, these are horrendous things that happen every single day in America. Do we need moral leadership? I don't think it's either or. We need both.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. Did the president go farther down a road of creating a shared experience because of this incident? Or does he run the risk by speaking perhaps only or largely to African Americans of reiterating, hey, it's a black thing. The rest of America isn't really going to understand. That's
no,
the way it's going to stay.
It's not a black thing. It's an American thing. When you have a kid who cannot walk where his father lives to be killed and for the killer to get off, that's an American thing. There's something wrong with that picture. I think the president has to step up. Now, you got to keep in mind there was some pressure points because you've got outrage, you've got protests. You had 100 cities marching and protesting at federal buildings. And so that's a pressure point. Politicians respond to pressure. And so I think this we need to look at these laws, but we in America, all of us, we all need to look at our racial attitudes and our racial prejudices, and I think we need some adjustment. And I have a question. My question to white males in America is, why are you afraid of the black male? What is the fear factor?
Is everyone afraid or just George Zimmerman?
It's not just George Zimmerman, because if it was just George Zimmerman, you would not have mass arrests. You could not speak to the experience that the president spoke to. Walking in a store and probably with credit cards and probably ready to purchase, and you are followed by guards. President said he had that experience. These are realities. This is not made up, and this is not 100 years ago. This is now. And we need a now discussion on race. Could the president lead it? Perhaps. I don't know if he could lead it, but he certainly needs to be at the table. And he does have the power of the pen. So the president, if you say, I am president of all of the people, of all of America, well, ain't Black America part of it too?
A discussion that will build that bridge. That's what we're talking about with Hermine Hartman, who's the editor-in-chief of Indigo Magazine. Hermine, thanks so much.
Thank you, John, and look forward to next time.
We're hearing stories of the lives of caregivers in America. We'd love to hear yours.
My name is Sharon from New Jersey. My husband is going to be 79 next month. He was diagnosed with Alzheimer's/Parkinson's disease in 1999. So I've been with him for 2 months now, 24/7, and there's really no time for me at all.
We're getting some great stories from listeners around the country of the value of the experience of having been a caregiver or what it's like to be a caregiver now. Share your story. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway using the hashtag #ICare4. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.